Okay, good morning. This is Bible 241, and it's Thursday, March 26th. We're going to finish up endocrine system, but I want to remind you that we do have a test next week on April 2nd, I believe, right? On April 2nd, that's Thursday, week from today, and it's going to be over autonomic nervous system, going to be over endocrinology, and over, what's the chapter in between? Ah, senses, that's right, senses. So autonomic nervous system, senses, and endocrine system. Okay, so we were talking about the pituitary gland, and remember that there are two main parts to the pituitary gland. What are the two main parts called? The anterior and the posterior pituitary. And what is the pituitary connected to? The hypothalamus, right, part of your brain. And how is it connected to the hypothalamus? Just in terms, yeah, via the infundibulum, right? But remember, there's two major pathways that go from the hypothalamus to the pituitary that go through the infundibulum. What are those two kinds of structures, two different structures, really different? They all take releasing hormones from the hypothalamus, so they're both, and they all go to the pituitary, so they're called the hypothalamo-hypophyseal something. There's one that's a tract. Where does that go to? I tell you what, what's a tract? What's a tract? Does anybody, everybody know what a tract is? What's a tract? Yeah, it's white matter in the central nervous system, so it's myelinated axons. Where do all those myelinated axons go? What part of the pituitary? Yeah, the posterior pituitary. Right, and it releases, when action potentials go down the tract, how many hormones can be released? Yeah, two. What are the two from the posterior pituitary? It's either ADH or oxytocin from the posterior pituitary. And then what's the communication like between the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary? Is it a tract? No. What is it? It's a portal blood vessel, right, that connects the two capillaries. First capillary bed in the hypothalamus, second capillary bed in the anterior pituitary. And what do you call that system, that portal system? There's a name. And you always start with where it originates from, and then the second part of the word is the destination. So hypothalamo, because it starts in the hypothalamus, and the hypophyseal portal system. Right, so, and a hypophysis is just another name for a pituitary gland. Okay, that's where that came from. All right, so you can see the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessels right here going through the infundibulum, going through the anterior pituitary, and the anterior pituitary will release a number of hormones. How many different hormones? You got six, two of them work together, and so two of them we can group together, and we call them gonadotropins because they affect the gonads. What are gonads? Give me some examples. Like ovaries and testes, right. All right, so what are the two gonadotropins? FSH and LH. So what does FSH do? And where does it work? Where does it go? Where does FSH go? Who's got a target tissue for FSH? Okay, or maybe a better way to say that, what organ has a receptor for FSH? Yeah, testes and ovary. So what's the effect of FSH on an ovary? Okay, FSH, what does FSH stand for? That's a really important clue. Follicle stimulating hormone. So FSH causes the maturation of a follicle. Right, so it allows for the maturation of an oocyte within a follicle. That's what FSH is for. And as a follicle grows and grows during the menstrual cycle, it releases more and more estrogen. So estrogen has a tendency to increase through the menstrual cycle. All right, so that's one of the gonadotropins. The other one is LH. What does LH do? When a follicle is mature and the oocyte is mature, it causes ovulation of that oocyte. Right, just into the pelvic cavity, and that's the job of LH. And the leftover follicle We don't call a follicle anymore. We call that a corpus luteum, and the corpus luteum stops or decreases the amount of estrogen that it secretes and starts to secrete another hormone, and that's progesterone. So the leftover follicle is a very important endocrine gland as well. It just doesn't degenerate right away. What about FSH in the male, on the testes? What does FSH do? Any effect whatsoever? Yes. Just like in the female, it stimulates the gamete production or the oocyte development. It stimulates gamete production in the male, and the male gamete is sperm, right? Sperm cells. So it stimulates spermatogenesis. What's the job of LH in the male? Or doesn't have a job? Yeah, it stimulates and causes the release of testosterone from the testes, from the interstitial cells. All right, and that testosterone is also important for spermatogenesis. So FSH and testosterone work together to promote spermatogenesis in the male. All right, what about ACTH? What does that stand for? Adrenal corticotropic hormone. And so where is ACTH released from? Anterior pituitary. And what's the target tissue? The adrenal cortex. And it causes the release of what? Basically two hormones. Okay, but norepinephrine comes from the adrenal medulla right here, not the adrenal cortex. And so don't forget, ACTH affects just the adrenal cortex. So actually there are three hormones, not just two. So let's actually think of all three of them. There are mineralocorticoids and glucocorticoids and androgens. What's the name of a mineralocorticoid? It affects sodium and potassium in your body, levels in your body. That is aldosterone. Yeah, aldosterone is the mineralocorticoid. And give me an example of a glucocorticoid. Cortisol is one. Cortisol is a glucocorticoid because it affects glucose metabolism. And then give me a name of an androgen. What's an androgen? An androgen is basically a male sex hormone. And a name of a male sex hormone. Give me a specific name of a male sex hormone. That would be testosterone, right? Okay. All right. What causes the release of TSH from the anterior pituitary? Yeah, TSHRH from the hypothalamus, right? And it comes down through the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system, and that stimulates the release of TSH. And then TSH goes to the thyroid gland, and that causes the secretion of thyroxine. And I think you're familiar with two forms of thyroxine. There's T3 and T4. And then that thyroxine feeds back, right, to the hypothalamus and to the anterior pituitary, so that if the thyroid doesn't produce a competent thyroid hormone, what happens to levels of TSH? If the thyroid can't make thyroid hormone, what happens to the levels of TSH? They skyrocket, right? Because the anterior pituitary can measure the levels of thyroid hormone in the blood, and if the thyroid can't make any to put in the blood, then the anterior pituitary is going to send large signals to the thyroid gland to increase production. So the thyroid gland is going to hypertrophy and get bigger, even though it maybe doesn't have iodine to make T3 and T4, right? But it still gets that signal, the TSH signal, that will cause it to hypertrophy. And what is that condition called? Hyperthyroidism would be a case where the thyroid actually makes a thyroxine hormone, right? And that, so there's going to be elevated levels of thyroid hormone in the plasma. But in this particular case, since there's no iodine maybe in somebody's diet, the thyroid gland can't make thyroxine. Okay, in that case, all right, so the thyroid gland gets bigger and bigger and bigger, but it isn't secreting anything that's useful to the body. So when it gets By hypertrophy, we means what? It gets bigger, it proliferates. And what's that condition called? That's goiter, right? And what would be an easy way to treat goiter? Yeah, just increase iodine in the diet. And how do we protect ourselves from goiter over here in the United States? Very easy to do. Yeah, because salt that you buy at the grocery store is fortified with iodine, right? So you have it in your diet that way. Okay, and prolactin. Where does prolactin come from? The anterior pituitary. And what's the target tissue for prolactin? Yeah, mammary glands. And what's the effect on mammary tissue? Okay. It stimulates the development of glandular tissue. Right? So not necessarily milk production, but it just allows for the glandular tissue to proliferate so that at the end of gestation, the breast is able to produce milk. Okay, and that's its primary role. It doesn't cause the milk letdown reflex. What does cause a milk letdown reflex? Yeah, oxytocin. Where does oxytocin come from? The posterior pituitary, right? So, and that's stimulated by infant nursing, right? Because there are signals then that go to the hypothalamus, which then cause release of oxytocin, and that causes a milk letdown reflex, and that is after gestation. Okay, so those are the hormones of the anterior pituitary, but be aware of the hormones from the posterior pituitary as well. All right, so here's a synopsis of what we were just talking about. And then, of course, be aware that all the anterior pituitary hormones are controlled by releasing factors from the hypothalamus that get to the anterior pituitary via the portal system. Okay. Okay. All right, so here you can see the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal tract, or no, not portal, it's not a portal tract. It's just the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract. Okay, adrenal gland. Sometimes we call that the suprarenal gland, yeah. TSH comes from the anterior pituitary. TSH comes from the anterior pituitary. Where does TSH, RH come from? That's from the hypothalamus. Oh, let's go back. I don't think I have a nice flowchart of everything like I do for gonadotropins right here. But for instance, here's the, what part of the brain is this right here? This is the, okay, this is the, all right, this is the hypothalamus, okay, because the thalamus is, somebody said thalamus, thalamus is up over here. Here's the hypothalamus, just right superior to the infundibulum. So the hypothalamus can monitor levels of thyroxin in the blood, and when it's low, then the hypothalamus is going to release TSH, RH into this first capillary bed. And where is that going to go? TSH, RH is going to go through the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessel right here into the anterior pituitary. TSH, RH is going to stimulate the release of TSH, thyroid-stimulating hormone. Thyroid-stimulating hormone leaves the anterior pituitary by these blood vessels, and it's taken to the thyroid. And, of course, the thyroid has receptors for TSH, so that's going to cause the thyroid gland to grow or to at least maintain itself, as well as secrete T3 and T4 into the blood. So releasing hormones come from the hypothalamus, and they're trophic hormones are released from the anterior pituitary. And we call these trophic hormones because they cause subsequent tissues to respond to them, to grow, to proliferate.
So for all the hormones that are produced by the pituitary gland, the hypothalamus senses the levels.
Right. Right. And for the anterior pituitary is controlled by releasing hormones for the posterior pituitary. That's really what? An extension of the hypothalamus. Those neurons come right down through the infundibulum, and when they depolarize, they release either oxytocin or ADH into the blood. All right, so yeah, releasing hormones are released here. So releasing hormones, I tell you what, let's think of releasing hormones and compare and contrast them with hormones from the posterior pituitary. So in some ways, they are similar. In what way are they similar? In which way are the releasing hormones similar to the hormones released from the posterior pituitary? Okay, they're released by neurons. I'm not sure if I heard anybody. A lot of people had some suggestions and I didn't quite hear about it. But they're both, what, released by neurons. So how should we really consider those hormones, all the releasing hormones as well as the two hormones from the posterior pituitary? They are neurohormones. But the hormones released from the anterior pituitary are true hormones because they're secreted by glandular tissue. Okay, so the distinction between releasing hormones and the hormones of the posterior pituitary is that the posterior pituitary directly affects tissues everywhere in the body that have receptors, but the releasing hormones only affect the anterior pituitary. Okay. So I think that answers your question pretty much. Okay. All right, so the adrenal gland, sometimes called the suprarenal gland because it is superior to the kidney. So here we see it right on top of the kidney. And of course, it's got two main divisions. It's got a deep division that we call the medulla. And what does that medulla secrete again? Yeah, epinephrine, primarily epinephrine, 80% epinephrine and a little bit of norepinephrine, 20% epinephrine. Because these cells are like the postganglionic fibers of an autonomic pathway. The superficial region is, of course, any superficial region of an organ we call the cortex, right? So here's the adrenal cortex. And it's responsible for secreting three different kinds of hormones. So if we look at a nice histological section of the adrenal cortex, as we see right here, we can see the different regions of the cortex. First, we see just the connective tissue capsule around the cortex that doesn't have a secretory function. The next deeper layer is a zona glomerulosa. And then the next deeper layer is very thick. That's the zona fasciculata. And then the deepest of the cortex is called the zona reticularis. Okay, and these are responsible for secreting either a glucocorticoid, a mineralocorticoid, or what, androgens, sex steroids. And the cortex is controlled by ACTH. So if ACTH goes away for whatever reason, what happens to the adrenal cortex? If ACTH disappears for some reason, what happens to the adrenal cortex? It atrophies. Okay, when I say atrophies, that means what? It's going to degenerate, it's going to go away. So adrenal cortex is dependent on the proper levels of ACTH from what organ? From the anterior pituitary, from the anterior pituitary, right? What causes the release of ACTH from the anterior pituitary? ACTHRH from the hypothalamus, right? Okay, so the three kinds of hormones released by the adrenal cortex, one class is cortisol that inhibits glucose utilization, right, and stimulates gluconeogenesis. So if you stimulate gluconeogenesis and you stop the use of glucose, what happens to glucose in your blood? What happens to plasma glucose? I don't know if you looked at this specifically in lab, but there's a little part in your lab book that talks about this. What happens to blood levels of glucose when cortisol is high? Yeah, it increases it, right? It increases it. Okay, as a matter of fact, there's only one hormone that I know of that actually decreases blood glucose. Everything else increases blood glucose. Okay. And since its effect is on glucose, we call it a glucocorticoid. On the other hand, aldosterone, we call that a mineralocorticoid because of its effects on sodium and potassium. And sodium and potassium are minerals that are inside your body. Right? These are just metals, metal ions. And aldosterone causes the retention of sodium. And it causes the secretion of potassium from your body. So aldosterone works on the kidney to resorb sodium. And when I say that, I mean that sodium is put in a fluid that eventually will become urine. We call that the filtrate. And aldosterone then takes sodium that's in the filtrate that will actually become part of urine. And then if it's in urine, when you void, then you lose it from your body. What aldosterone does is take sodium out of the filtrate and puts it back into your blood, right? So we call that resorption. So sodium is put back in your blood, but you lose potassium as a result of aldosterone. All right, so you might see a board question sometime in your life, and you'll see, well, what's the name of a hormone that has opposite effects on sodium and potassium? And you might have a list of different hormones you could choose from. And there's only one that has opposite effects on sodium and potassium, and that is aldosterone. All right, so that's kind of an easy way to think of it. So if you can't remember that aldosterone always causes sodium retention, right? Or if the question is aldosterone, look for an answer that has what? Opposite effects on sodium and potassium, and that's going to be the right answer. All right? And then, of course, that might give you a clue how to answer some other questions, too. Like sodium retention is caused by aldosterone, but potassium loss is also caused by aldosterone. All right, so there's something else that happens when you resorb salt. And for instance, I think that Cinco de Mayo is coming up pretty soon, right? And you might go out and drink a bunch of margaritas or something that evening. And how might you wake up the next day? Bloated. Did I mention this already? Oh, I did. Oh, okay. I didn't know I was just reviewing for you guys. Okay, because as sodium is resorbed, right, from the filtrate, water comes along with it just by, what's that process by which water moves down a concentration gradient across membranes? Osmosis, right? So when aldosterone works to resorb sodium, water is resorbed as well, right, by osmosis. Okay, and as your fluid levels increase, what happens to blood pressure? Okay. Yeah, so aldosterone is very important for maintaining blood pressure for the following reason. For instance, if you walk out to the parking lot when you go home this afternoon or tonight or whenever you get to go home, and you see that your tire is flat because there's low pressure in the tire, what do you do to that tire? Do you take air out or you put air in to boost the pressure up? Yeah, you have to put air in, right? So the same thing for blood pressure. When your blood pressure is low, guess what your body does? Does it take fluid out of your blood or put fluid into your circulatory system? It puts fluid in, and that will maintain your blood pressure. So aldosterone increases blood pressure because of that effect. Okay, and then of course the adrenal cortex also produces some androgens or sex steroids. And this slide right here just shows the three main layers of the adrenal cortex and the three main hormones that it produces. Aldosterone, that's a mineralocorticoid, because what's the effect of aldosterone again? Sodium retention, right? Sodium retention. And glucocorticoids, what do? They boost blood glucose. They boost blood glucose levels, right? And sex steroids, mainly androgens, what do? I don't think I talked about this, but they're responsible. Yeah, male secondary sex characteristics, you know, like what, coarser, thicker hair, stronger bones, more muscle mass. But females have an adrenal cortex, right? And they secrete androgens as well. So there are other responses that the androgens produce, and that is basically reproductive drive, which is, of course, necessary for perpetuation of the species, and aggressive behavior. All right, so it's not just males that have aggressive behavior because they have androgens, but females do as well. And of course, everybody could argue that aggressive behavior from females is probably even more amazing than from males. Okay? And in, under what circumstances would you think? Yeah, like maternal behavior, right? For instance, if you're walking out in the woods and you run across a really cute, cuddly little cub bear or something, you want to sit down and have a little picnic with this little tiny bear? No, there's no way. You're lucky if you get out of there alive, right? Okay, so that is protective maternal behavior produced by androgens from the adrenal cortex. Yeah, question? I don't know of any. Yeah, but I don't know what it is. You know, and I don't know if there should be any measurable amounts of estrogen in the male, to tell you the truth. Okay? And I don't know what the level of androgens in the female is. But that's interesting. I might do a Google. Somebody at Wikipedia probably knows something like that pretty easily. Okay, so when you look at this table right here, I want you to at least know the three different layers of the adrenal cortex responsible for these three different kinds of hormones. And you can see that what is the basic precursor molecule for all of these hormones? It's cholesterol, right? So all of these hormones are related to each other via cholesterol. You don't have to memorize the pathways involved right here, but you should at least know that they're all related to each other. And what is their basic nature? Are they hydrophilic or hydrophobic kinds of molecules? Yeah, they're all hydrophobic because cholesterol is a lipid. And so where do you have receptors and target tissues for these hormones? They're inside the cell, right? Because these hormones can actually enter the cell, go right through the plasma membrane, and in most cases they're going to have a genomic effect inside the cell. That means they're going to affect transcription. Okay. So we might have a chance to look at some of those a little bit later on. Okay, the adrenal medulla secretes primarily epinephrine. It has a longer half-life, about 10 times longer than norepinephrine. And the adrenal medulla is innervated by the preganglionic sympathetic fibers. So the cells of the adrenal medulla, those are the chromaffin cells, act like the postganglionic fiber. And so when they depolarize, they release epinephrine and a little bit of norepinephrine. And this causes mass activation of the fight or flight response. And so that's when you're presented with a very stressful stimulus. So how would you want your body to respond to a very stressful stimulus? What about respiratory rate? Increasing, because you're going to be using muscles to deal with that threat. And when muscles exercise, they need to use up ATP. How do you generate ATP? What's a very efficient way to make ATP? Oxidative phosphorylation. So you need to get that oxygen in your bodies, right? And to move that oxygen around through your cardiovascular system, your heart rate goes way up. And when the heart rate goes way up, the amount of blood that's pumped per minute goes way up. We call that cardiac output. Cardiac output is just the volume of blood that's pumped by your heart every minute. And there's a general vasoconstriction, which increases venous return, and that increases blood pressure. So another really simple model to think of is, say, you have a balloon that's filled with, say, water, and you start to squeeze the balloon. What happens to the pressure inside the balloon? It increases, right? So vasoconstriction increases blood pressure, and that's going to help maintain blood flow to muscles that are exercising. Right, so vasoconstriction. And vasodilation, on the other hand, there was some way that you could actually stretch the balloon, pull it out, what would happen to pressure inside the balloon if you were able to grab it, like glue your hands to a water balloon and move your hands apart? What would happen to the pressure? It would actually decrease, right? So constricting the balloon would increase the pressure. And epinephrine, as we saw before, increases glycogenolysis. Remember that slide that showed the two adrenergic kinds of receptors, the alpha adrenergic and the beta adrenergic receptors? Epinephrine can't get inside the cell. So where is the receptor for epinephrine in terms of glycogenolysis. It is outside the cell. So how does a signal get inside the cell? How does a signal that stimulates glycogenolysis get inside a cell? Yeah, through some kind of second messenger system, right? And could you tell me any second messengers that were involved with this right here? And this is lucky because you could name a couple of them and you'd be correct. Okay, calcium is one, and cyclic AMP is the other one. Right, so the liver has both alpha-adrenergic and beta-adrenergic receptors that stimulate glycogenolysis and lipolysis as well. Okay. All right, the thyroid gland. So the thyroid gland is just below the larynx, which is the voice box right here, right, just below and lateral on either side. And the thyroid gland is responsible for secreting thyroxin, which is what, T3 and T4. T4 is primarily what's released from the thyroid gland. T3 is the active component once it reaches your cells. Now, what can you tell me about T3 and T4? Is it similar to steroid hormones, for instance, or is it different? It's similar because why? Because it's hydrophobic, right? So T3 and T4, actually T4 can enter the cell, so there are intracellular receptors for when T4 enters, it gets converted to T3, and then there are receptors for T3, right? And these affect the basal metabolic rate. T3 is needed for growth as well as development. Basal metabolic rate is just the overall metabolic activity that's happening inside your body. It determines how much energy you need when you're in a resting state, not when you're in an exercising state, but just you're pretty much in a resting state right now. I'm probably not resting because I'm talking and standing, but you guys are probably in a more basal state. So if thyroid hormone disappears, your basal metabolic rate decreases. All right, so what does that mean? What is your caloric intake requirement? What happens to your caloric intake requirement if your basal metabolic rate decreases? If you want to keep a constant weight, what happens to it? It decreases because your basal metabolic rate decreases. You don't need as much energy to perform the same activity. So when there is hypothyroidism, right, basal metabolic rate decreases, people have a tendency to feel lethargic, but also to gain a lot of weight as a result of that. Right, if there's hyperthyroidism, your basal metabolic rate increases. That's characterized by nervousness, right, disturbance of sleep cycles, and it might be very difficult for you to maintain weight as a result of that because of the change of basal metabolic rate. But during development, it's also important for growth of your entire body, including nervous system. Okay. So the thyroid gland consists of a microscopic follicle. So I mentioned follicles before, but I didn't really show you. Follicles inside the ovary. A follicle is just a ring structure, a spherical structure with fluid on the inside of it. But these are microscopic. The outer layers of a follicle are cells that synthesize T4, and these T4 molecules then get secreted to the inside of the follicle. And the inside of the follicle has a fluid that we call the colloid. So it's a mixture of different chemical compounds, right? Which includes a lot of proteins, which are just barely soluble in that fluid. So here is a follicle, and we can see that it's only one cell layer thick. Other kinds of follicles in your body might be many cell layers thick. All right, so these are the cells that synthesize and secrete T4 into the colloid right here. And iodine is necessary, all right, in order to make that thyroid-stimulating hormone. And in order to get TSH to dissolve into the colloid, it's got to be bound to thyroglobulin. All right, and when where does TSH come from? Because the thyroid gland, this gland right here, right, is secreting thyroxin, or T3 and T4. What causes the release of T3 and T4 from the thyroid gland? That is TSH, thyroid-stimulating hormone. Where does the thyroid-stimulating hormone come from? the pituitary, and in particular the anterior part. And how does the anterior pituitary know to release thyroid stimulating hormone? Because the hypothalamus releases TSHRH. Okay. And when that happens, then T3 and T4 are released from thyroglobulin and put into the plasma, where they bind to carrier proteins in the plasma. Okay, as a result of TSH secretion. So here is probably an exam figure. Is this an exam figure? Is this ringing a bell? No? Okay, well, let's talk about this one anyway. All right, so the hypothalamus releases, okay, now this is what I call TSHRH. Your book calls it thyroid releasing hormone or thyrotropin releasing hormone. That's the same thing. You could also call it what? TSHRF releasing factor. So these have different names. This is a neurohormone from the hypothalamus. It gets to the anterior pituitary. How does it get to that anterior pituitary? The hypothalamo-hypophyseal what? Portal system. Don't say tract, because the tract is neuronal tissue. All right, and that causes the release of TSH, which then goes to the thyroid. And tell me something about the thyroid that allows it to respond to TSH. It's got to have a receptor. Yeah, it's got to have a receptor, an intracellular receptor. And if iodine is present, then the thyroid gland is going to make proper levels of T3 and T4. They're going to be in your blood. And that blood goes everywhere, including the anterior pituitary. In the anterior pituitary, there's going to be a set point for the proper level of thyroxin. And remember, thyroxin is what, T3 and T4? And so as the levels of T3 and T4 increase, what happens to the levels of TSH? Okay, if T3 and T4 increase, maybe even above threshold, or above the set point, what happens to TSH? It decreases, right, because this is a negative feedback loop, all right, and when TSH decreases, so do the levels of T3 and T4, it goes back to the set point, and then this feedback loop turns off, right, so here's a nice negative feedback loop that is maintaining the proper levels of T3 and T4. If, however, there is inadequate iodine in somebody's diet, then the product of the thyroid gland is not competent, and it won't affect the anterior pituitary. It won't feed back to the anterior pituitary, shutting off TSH release. As a matter of fact, the anterior pituitary is going to say, oh, there's no T3 and T4 in the body. What would the anterior pituitary decide to do if there's no T3 and T4 being produced in the body? Yeah, it's going to increase the production of TSH. Right, and it's going to tell the thyroid to get busy and make a lot of T3 and T4. The thyroid is going to listen to that signal, and it's going to get bigger. It's going to hypertrophy. But if it doesn't have iodine, no luck, right? It can't make thyroxin. So as a result, there is no negative feedback to the anterior pituitary that produces an excess of TSH, which causes hypertrophy of the thyroid gland, and that's what we call goiter as a result of that, which can be treated very easily by what? Just by introducing some iodine into the diet. All right, because TSH is what we call a trophic hormone. Could you give me the name of another trophic hormone from the anterior pituitary? Yeah, ACTH is a trophic hormone, as a matter of fact. All of the anterior pituitary hormones are what we call trophic hormones because it will cause maintenance and even hypertrophy of the various target tissues that they that respond to them. Okay. There are two other hormones secreted by organs that or glandular tissue that are inside the thyroid or right next to the thyroid. One is called parathyroid hormone. And you might have a picture of the parathyroid glands, but they're on the posterior part of the thyroid, so we'd have to flip this one around to look at the posterior side. There are four little nodules, two on either side, that release parathyroid hormone, and these are very important for regulating blood calcium levels. Now, what good is calcium? Why do you need to have calcium in your body? Communication between cells, right, for synaptic transmission. Calcium is important for fusion of the synaptic vesicles, but it's also important for maintaining proper bone density, for the strength of bones. So it should be regulated. There should be a high degree of regulation with blood calcium. So decreasing blood calcium stimulates the parathyroid, so the sensors for blood calcium are contained right within the parathyroid glands themselves. Right? And the parathyroids then respond by releasing parathyroid hormone, which goes all over the body, in particular to kidneys. And again, in the kidneys, they have a tendency to throw almost everything out that's in the blood, including calcium. But parathyroid hormone will tell the kidneys to resorb calcium from that fluid that eventually will become urine. Right, so that calcium you would lose in the urine, but the parathyroid hormone is going to tell the kidneys to take that calcium and put it back into the blood. So we call that resorption. So kidneys will resorb calcium from the kidney filtrate. So that's going to feed back, okay, to the initial stimulus. What was the initial stimulus? Was a decreasing blood calcium. But this right here, increasing blood calcium, is what we call the response, right? And if the response subtracts from the initial stimulus, that's a nice negative feedback loop that maintains homeostasis. All right, so increasing blood calcium due to this activity of the kidneys decreases what? The loss of calcium in urine. So it decreases urinary excretion of calcium. That's one effect of parathyroid hormone. The other effect is that it has an effect on bones. It causes the dissolution of hydroxyapatite from bones, with calcium phosphate crystals, and then that calcium as well as phosphate go into the blood, and that increases blood calcium levels. So what kind of cells does parathyroid hormone stimulate that actually break bone down? What kind of cells break bone down? The osteoclasts. Yeah, osteoclasts. So parathyroid hormone affects osteoclasts. And you should know three different names of osteocytes. What are three different kinds of osteocytes? You got clasts, which break bone down. What else do you have? Blasts. What do? They build bone up. And the third kind is? Yeah, just the sites, the osteocytes that you find in mature bone. So which are antagonistic to each other? The clasts and the blasts, right? And so you have to have proper balance between osteoclastic activity and osteoblastic activity to maintain your bones. And we see that parathyroid hormone here stimulates the osteoclast. So you might expect that there is a hormone that could possibly stimulate what? Osteoblasts to maintain your bones. And indeed there is. We're sort of unsure in humans what the effect is, but in animals it's been pretty clear. That hormone is called calcitonin. And calcitonin comes from the thyroid gland, from cells that are outside the follicle. So those would be the parafollicular cells release calcitonin. And calcitonin has the opposite effect of parathyroid hormone. So in terms of bone right here, so let's just review. Parathyroid hormone causes what happened to bones? What happens to bone in the presence of parathyroid hormone? Yeah, they break down. Right, they get weaker. But in the presence of calcitonin, that's going to have a tendency to build bones. It's going to take calcium out of the blood and put it into bone. Right, and so we say bone really is a reservoir for calcium ions. Right, but in humans, we're kind of unsure what that calcitonin does, because what's a very prevalent disease process that we're all going to experience if we're lucky enough to live old enough that will affect our bones? Osteoporosis, and females are certainly more susceptible than males. And you would guess from this mechanism that we just talked about, well, if somebody has osteoporosis, how come we just don't bolus them with some calcitonin to build their bones back up? And I don't have a really good answer for you. That seems like a nice, simple solution. Okay, but so maybe look forward to finding some information out about that sometime soon. Yeah. Can you ever have too much calcium? Yeah, probably so. I don't know under what conditions, though, that might happen. You can get tumors, you know, pretty much in any different parts of your body. So you might get a tumor in the parathyroid gland, which are those little nodules, and if it's such a tumor that produces too much parathyroid hormone, then, you know, that's really going to destroy your bones and you'll have too much calcium in your blood. Or maybe you could have a tumor in another part of the thyroid that's going to secrete calcitonin, and now you won't have enough calcium in plasma, but your bones will get really big and ossified. Yeah, so it can go either way. It's certainly a possibility. Some people are more prone to kidney stones than others. Some people, and that also depends a little bit on your diet. So, for instance, if you're a person that stays well hydrated, if you happen to drink a lot of water, if you don't dehydrate yourself, then you'll have a tendency to be able to excrete that calcium without the formation of stones. But if, for whatever reason, if you don't maintain your fluid balance very well, if you don't void a lot of fluid, then that's going to have a tendency to precipitate calcium in kidneys and give you kidney stones. So it's related that way. Yeah, the parathyroid hormone actually breaks down bone. Releasing calcium into the blood, because that's where it's very important to have proper calcium levels. All right, so for synaptic transmission, so our nervous systems wouldn't work without the proper level of calcium in plasma. And it sure would, and that's exactly what happens as we get older. Right, there is some imbalance between osteoblastic activity and osteoclastic activity as we get older, and our bones actually do get weaker as we get older. And in women, that happens much earlier and to a much more pathological degree. Okay, yeah. But when we get into the next chapter, which is muscle, we're going to see another important reason for having calcium. Yeah, so I know it's kind of shocking to think of that, but you should really think of calcium in bone as being a reservoir for calcium. That's not the most important place where you should have calcium in your body. It just so happens that it's really handy and fortunate because it makes your bones strong. But there are other processes in your body that need calcium, and when those processes need calcium because maybe you don't have the proper level in your diet, where do they get that calcium from? Your bones. And then what happens to your bones? They get weaker. Yeah, that's just the unfortunate fact of life. Okay. Mean parathyroid hormone or? Oh, osteoporosis. It's much more prevalent in females than males. All right, and there may be a couple links to that, and that is bone deposition also seems to be dependent on sex steroids like estrogen and testosterone, but typically through a male's life, their testosterone will decrease, but not to the same drastic amount that estrogen in a female will decrease postmenopausally. All right, so in order to maintain strong bones, sometimes you do need estrogen. So sometimes a physician might say you need estrogen replacement therapy postmenopausally. Okay, and that might help protect bones, but there are side effects to that. Okay, heart disease, for instance, maybe breast cancer, uterine cancer, things like that. So there's no real easy... Oh, that's the helicopter taking off. Cool. Okay. Well, hopefully it will take off the way it should and not end up in here. okay. And I guess maybe in this class we haven't talked about that, but that's a process. Now, why does it affect females more than males? Well, because testosterone doesn't decrease quite so much in males, but the other reason is because males typically have bigger, thicker bones, and so when they lose calcium from their bones, they can afford to lose more before it becomes a pathological condition. But females typically, at least within a family, have smaller bones, and so when they lose a little bit of calcium, it becomes more significant in their daily life as a result. So if you're a female and you have a very slight bony structure, very dainty bony structure, you're the most susceptible to osteoporosis. But if you're fortunate to be a female with big, strong bones, then you're more protected from osteoporosis. Oh, what do they do? Yeah, you know, that's an area that's changing a lot, and I just haven't kept on top of that. And that's really important, and you should talk to a clinician who really knows what the state-of-the-art treatment is. But in our group, what's really important, how do you protect yourself from osteoporosis before you need treatment? And that is the proper diet. Make sure you have proper calcium in your diet so that you can absorb it into your body. You need proper vitamin D to help absorption of calcium from your diet. So you need proper diet for vitamin D as well as calcium. And then the other thing that's very helpful is exercise. Because how does your body respond to stress? Like if you have a muscle, your biceps right here, okay, and you how do you stress a biceps? Contract it. Yeah, contract it. So if you were to walk around with a 5-pound weight all day long, okay, for about 6 months, what would that biceps be like? It'd be huge. It'd be big and strong, right? And if you exercise a bone, guess how it's going to respond? Because remember, it's a living tissue. It's going to hypertrophy as well. It's going to get bigger and stronger. And that's the perfect way to protect yourself from bone loss as we get older, right? So like so many things in physiology that we don't want to hear, the proper way to deal with these things is with, when you're healthy, diet and exercise, having the proper diet and exercise, right? And for women, that would be premenopausally. And maybe even exercise postmenopausally is protective to some degree too, but no one's really looked at that as far as I know, okay, scientifically. All right, so we see that the osteoclasts and osteoblasts are antagonistic to each other, but is that generally a good thing or a bad thing? That's generally a good thing, right, because that produces balance in your body. And now you can see that there are two important hormones that help regulate that activity, namely parathyroid hormone, right, that stimulates osteoclastic activity, and calcitonin, which I only can hypothesize probably promotes osteoblastic activity. But I don't know of any scientific studies that actually prove that to be true. Okay. But don't forget, for sure, what's true is bone is living tissue, and when you exercise it, it's going to respond by getting bigger and stronger. And that really explains why bones have processes on them. What is a process on a bone? What's a process on a bone? Ah, you got to switch classes real quick. What's a process? A process is a rough raised area on a bone, right? So it's a prominent bony feature that sticks above a bone somehow. And if you were to feel it with your fingertips, it would be raised, but it would also be rough. So what's the function of a process typically? It's for muscle attachment. So that's the exact point where a muscle is pulling on a bone. And that exact point does what? It hypertrophies. It gets bigger and stronger. Right? So if you do that to the whole bone is going to get bigger and stronger as well. Okay? And protects from osteoporosis. All right, so don't forget how to talk about a response loop. A response loop always starts with a stimulus and it ends in a response, right? It's got to have an integration center. And if the response subtracts from the stimulus, then that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so looking at calcitonin and parathyroid hormone is kind of a nice introduction to looking at the pancreas. And the pancreas is pretty interesting. So here's the tail of the pancreas, here's the head of the pancreas, and here you can see a nice big duct, the pancreatic duct running through the interior of the pancreas. So what kind of gland uses a duct to secrete something? An exocrine gland, right? So the pancreas is part exocrine gland. It synthesizes and releases digestive enzymes. And where do those digestive enzymes go? Into the small intestine right here, where they digest food that we eat. And those digestive hormones shouldn't be running around inside the pancreas digesting anything, right? Because that's what we would call pancreatitis. It's really a nasty disease when your pancreas basically dissolves itself. All right, but in this particular chapter, we're not so interested in the exocrine function of the pancreas. We want to know something about the endocrine function of the pancreas. So again, what is an endocrine gland? It doesn't have ducts, right? So the endocrine part of the pancreas doesn't utilize these ducts right here. It just utilizes the blood supply, right, that flows into the pancreas, and the hormones then enter through capillaries of the pancreas. So there are little sections within the pancreas that look like little islands, and those are called the islands of Langerhans because there was, I don't know who Langerhans was, if it was a male or female, or Langerhans sounds kind of European anyway, first did some microscopy of the pancreas and noticed these different cells that are hanging out inside the pancreas, and noticed a couple different kinds of cells. And what was the first cell that this person recognized? That was the alpha cell. Yeah, I'm only kind of guessing, kind of silly. But in the second cell that they noticed, they call, oh, well, let's call that a beta cell. And then through other kinds of research, people realized that alpha cells actually secrete a hormone, right? And that hormone is glucagon. And the beta cells secrete another hormone, and that is called insulin. Okay. So it would have been nicer, I think, if that person saw the beta cells first, because then they would have called that the alpha. But you got to remember, insulin comes from the beta cells. Okay. And there are receptors for glucose right in these cells. They don't need another receptor, so these cells can monitor blood glucose concentration. And when blood glucose increases, the beta cells under normal conditions respond by releasing insulin. When blood glucose decreases, the alpha cells respond by releasing glucagon. All right, so one increases blood glucose, the other decreases blood glucose. So what's the effect of insulin and glucagon? How would you describe the relationship between insulin and glucagon? They're antagonistic. Similar to, okay, in a sense of producing antagonism, similar to what two other hormones? What two other hormones are antagonistic to each other? That we just talked about even. Is what? Parathyroid hormone and calcitonin. Okay, so what does parathyroid hormone do again? It increases blood calcium, and calcitonin decreases blood calcium, right? And so that's a nice antagonistic mechanism. Well, let's talk about that antagonism just for another second. What parts of your nervous system are antagonistic to each other? You have two whole different nervous systems. Yeah, the autonomic nervous system, that will be on your test next week, right? Sympathetic and parasympathetic are antagonistic to each other. So you have many antagonistic systems in your body maintaining precise control and balance. And of course, the proper levels of blood glucose are important because, why might you think they're important? Why is it important to have control over your blood glucose concentration? Okay, because it's a very important energy molecule, for sure, because that's what you make ATP from, right? And so if you have too much in your blood, your body wants to store it. In what form does your body store excess glucose? In glycogen, but it can also be converted into lipids, for instance. You don't want to throw that molecule away, right? And if you have way too much blood glucose, guess what your kidneys do? They actually throw it away, which is a big waste of energy, right? So you need hormones to control blood levels so they don't get too high so that you don't lose it. A good example, a way to think about that is, what's an energy molecule that you use in your car? Yeah, gasoline, right? And you ever want to lose any gasoline? No. Like, for instance, if you would never go to the gas station, fill up your gas tank, and then put a hole in the gas tank, right, and let it dribble out, right? So your body does the same thing. It doesn't want to lose any glucose once you are lucky enough to get glucose, so, right, it stores it. It takes it out of your circulation so that the kidney doesn't lose track of it, doesn't lose that important energy molecule in urine. So let's look and see how that happens. Okay, so the alpha cells secrete glucagon in response to low blood glucose. All right, and if your blood glucose is too low, your brain won't be able to function. All right, and of course, then you'll lose homeostasis. And glucagon stimulates glycogenolysis. All right, what is glycogenolysis? Yeah, the breakdown of glycogen into glucose. What, 1-phosphate and then to glucose 6-phosphate, and then there's a phosphatase that takes the phosphate off of glucose 6-phosphate, and it can enter the blood, and then all the tissues can use that glucose. And it also stimulates lipolysis. And lipolysis is the first step by which you can make ATP from lipids. So what's the second step, the second pathway that comes after lipolysis, where your body can use lipid molecules for the production of ATP? That's what I was thinking of. Beta oxidation, yeah. And where does beta oxidation take place? That's in mitochondria, right? That requires oxygen for that to happen. All right, so anyway, glucagon increases blood glucose. So when is it important to maintain your blood glucose? Right after you've gone to the Dairy Queen? Or maybe when you wake up first thing in the morning? Right, when you're in a fasted state. When you're not absorbing glucose from your gastrointestinal tract, right, that's when your blood glucose is going to have a tendency to decrease. But the pancreas, as a matter of fact, what the alpha cells sense that, and they release glucagon, which affects the liver to break glycogen down, and then that glucose ends up in the blood. And of course, there is the response is going to subtract from the stimulus. So this is what a nice negative feedback loop. So the set point is in the alpha cells that will maintain blood glucose when you're in a fasted state. Now, when you're in a fed state, what happens? After you've gone to Dairy Queen. Okay. What is Dairy Queen? You know what a Dairy Queen is? Probably don't. Dairy Queen is where you go get ice cream. Okay. It's like a Tasty Freeze or something. Okay. Well, it was a very popular place before there were a lot of automobiles running around. Okay. So when you're in a fed state, you're absorbing a lot of glucose from your diet, and that goes into your blood. All right, and if it goes too high, then you're just going to secrete or excrete that glucose into urine. You'll lose the value of that energy. So your bodies have figured out a way to decrease blood glucose by letting cells take glucose up from the blood. And what is that passport signal that allows cells to take up glucose? That is insulin. And when glucose goes from the plasma into cells, that decreases blood glucose levels. Right? And so what kind of cell secretes insulin? And where is it located? It's the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas. Right? So when you're in a fed state, insulin promotes entry of glucose. So you should think of how does that glucose get inside cells? How does it get in? How does insulin actually work to allow cells to take up glucose? Yeah, there's got to be a receptor. And insulin is a protein hormone. It's not hydrophobic. It's a hydrophilic molecule. So where's the receptor at? Outside the cell. And you should actually have a nice picture of what that receptor looks like. What kind of receptor is that? What kind of receptor is the insulin receptor? It's a tyrosine kinase receptor, right? And when insulin is there, it dimerizes, it phosphorylates itself, and then it phosphorylates other regulatory proteins in the cell, which then eventually does what? How can glucose enter the cell? So there's got to be a special transporter, protein transporter, that is put into the membrane to allow glucose to move across the membrane. What is that transporter called? You should know the name of that transporter. That is the GLUT4 transporter. And they're stored in an endosome. And what insulin does is that it allows for the fusion of that endosome to the plasma membrane. So the GLUT4 transporters are put in the plasma membrane, and then glucose can enter the cell. So tell me something about that process where glucose enters the cell. So when you think about a membrane transport process, what are the two main kinds of processes for membrane transport? This goes back a couple months. You have active transport versus passive transport. And how does glucose get into the cell, active or passive? It's a passive transport. So that means glucose can only go which way? From high concentration to low concentration. But glucose by itself can't get through the plasma membrane. So it needs a transporter. What kind of passive transport allows a molecule to move through the membrane that needs help? That's called facilitated diffusion. So the GLUT4 transporter allows for facilitated diffusion of glucose going from high concentration in the blood to low concentration in the cell. And in most cells, that glucose can't get out. If the concentration gradient were to switch, why can't glucose ever leave a cell like a muscle cell? Because it becomes phosphorylated right away, which is a big hydrophilic molecule, and for sure the phosphate can't get through the plasma membrane, so it's trapped inside the cell. All right, so let's look at this feedback loop I think we got pretty much just insulin right here. right? But if the response is, in a fed state, increased blood glucose, the beta cells of the pancreas will monitor and notice that. It will make a decision then to increase insulin secretion, which is going to insert all of those GLUT4 transporters into the membrane. So that's going to increase cellular uptake of glucose. And what's the effect of blood glucose going to be then? If the cells take it up, then blood glucose decreases. So that's the response. And the response does what to the stimulus? It subtracts from, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism, maintaining the proper level of blood glucose. And when cells take up glucose, what happens? Glucose, if you're not exercising, for instance, glucose then will be converted to glycogen. It will be stored. All right. And glucose also can be converted into triglycerides. So adipose cells just love to take glucose and turn it into triglycerides, right? And, of course, muscle and liver will store glucose in the form of glycogen, not in the form of triglycerides. And then the third possible fate for glucose uptake would be, for instance, if it's an exercising muscle, what is that muscle going to do with glucose? It's not going to convert it into glycogen. It's going to catabolize it and make ATP out of it, right? Okay, so here is a nice negative feedback loop that helps maintain proper level. But insulin then works with glucagon in an antagonistic fashion to maintain the proper level of glucose in the blood. So you should think of parathyroid hormone, calcitonin, parasympathetic nervous system, sympathetic nervous system. And another example would be, how about in the musculoskeletal system? Give me two names of muscles. Okay. Smooth and cardiac. I'm not quite thinking that way. I'm actually thinking of names of skeletal muscles. Like, for instance, skeletal muscles that are antagonistic to each other. Okay, for instance, the triceps. Yeah, what does the triceps do? They extend the forearm. And what's a muscle that's antagonistic to the triceps brachii? Yeah, the biceps or the brachialis. Right, so those are antagonistic muscles. So your body uses antagonism all over the place for precise control and balance, right? So you have nervous system, you have endocrine systems, you got musculoskeletal systems that all rely on antagonism. Very important concept. All right, so that actually kind of leads us to the next topic, and that is the muscles. I didn't put this online for you to look at yet. But I'll just show you a couple slides to get you involved with muscles. Muscles are not on the test coming up. And what chapter is that? I think that's 12. Okay, so a lot of the first part of this chapter is just review from anatomy. Oh, sign-in sheet. Where's that sign-in sheet at? Yeah? Did everybody sign it? Don't forget to sign it. Okay, if you have it. All right, so what are the four main tissues that your body's made out of again? Muscle is one. Nervous tissue, epithelium, and connective tissue, right? So muscle is a kind of tissue, and furthermore, you could break muscle down into how many major kinds of muscle? There's smooth, cardiac, and skeletal, right? So you should remember the distinction between those three different kinds. Which of those kinds is under voluntary control? I'm not quite sure. Only skeletal, right? Only skeletal. Which is under involuntary control? Cardiac and smooth. Which ones are striated? Is this ringing a bell? Striated. Which ones are striated? Cardiac muscle is striated and skeletal muscle is striated and smooth muscle is not striated. So what about muscle? What's inside of a muscle that gives those striations, that make those striations? Okay. And it is the structural and functional unit of shortening or contraction. And the structural and functional unit of contraction is the, you're right, it is a sarcomere. Right? And a sarcomere is just a little subcellular component that repeats itself over and over again from one end of the muscle cell to the other, which produces those striations. All right, so that's another important thing for you to realize, is that you like to think of structural and functional units in anatomy and physiology. Like, what's the structural and functional unit of life? That's a cell. What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? That would be a synapse, and there's a special kind of synapse between a nerve and a muscle that's called the neuromuscular junction. That's just a specific example of a kind of synapse. All right, so the structural and functional unit of contraction is a sarcomere, so that's actually what we're going to spend a lot of time on in this class, is looking to see how a sarcomere actually shortens and how your cell controls a sarcomere. All right, so the first couple slides, right, just our definitions from anatomy. You should know what flexors are and extensors, and then all the different kinds of motions. Like, for instance, when you point your toes into the ground, what's that called? That's called plantar flexion. When you lift your toes up, that is dorsiflexion. So review all those different actions, because I might use them in a discussion. All right, and don't forget your basic anatomy of how you build a muscle. Don't forget a muscle is an organ. All right, so I do want to go over this right before we go. Okay, so here's a muscle, an organ, and of course muscles attach to bones via tendons, dense regular connective tissue. And then the basic building block of a muscle are these groups of muscle cells. So this group of muscle cells right here is called a fascicle. Maybe sometimes you had learned that's called a bundle. A bundle or a fascicle is really the same thing. All right, and the building block of a fascicle are individual muscle cells, and these muscle cells are very long, kind of tubular in nature, but they actually look like threads. They look more like threads, so we call muscle cells muscle fibers, because they really look like threads. They're very, very long, and they're really, really long because at one point in time they were thousands of individual cells that fused together to make this big, long fiber. And as a result, each fiber contains the remnants of all those nuclei from all those progenitor cells. So skeletal muscle is also characterized as being what? Multinucleated. It has many nuclei because they came from all those thousands of cells that came together. So here's a muscle fiber. So another name for a muscle fiber is a muscle cell. But you can see there's even some structure inside the muscle cell. We see more things that kind of look like threads. These are the organelles for contraction, and these are what we call myofibrils. All right, and so the building block of a muscle fiber are myofibrils, and then there are even structures inside a myofibril that you should know about, and these are what we call filaments, myofilaments. And so these are the proteins that are responsible for contraction, and you should know at least two kinds of myofilaments. What are the two kinds? Actin and myosin. One is the thick one, and that's called the myosin, and the thin one is called the actin molecule. And the way actin and myosin is arranged within a myofibril produces a sarcomere and then that striated appearance. All right, so make sure that you kind of know the organization. Tuesday. We'll go over this Tuesday. So Tuesday, we'll have a lecture on muscle, and then Thursday, your test. Okay.